Good to see everybody here this morning. If you've got a Bible handy, and I hope you do, then open up to the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. It's right halfway through the Old Testament in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. If you don't have a Bible handy, there should be one in the pew in front of you, or you can find it on the internet on your smartphone, or if you've got your 2,000-year-old Greek manuscript handy in your pocket, pull that out as well. We're going to be in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 here in just a few moments. I want to start off by prefacing today's lesson by saying that this subject is never easy to talk about. We're going to talk about the idea of preparing oneself for death. I know that there's always bad news in a congregation. We had some bad news earlier this week. I think most of us are aware of a situation or two in our congregation where family members or members of our own church, they're facing challenges in their health. Things don't always look good physically. There's never a good time to talk about this. But I suppose since there's never a good time to talk about it, maybe that just means it's always a good time to talk about it. I put this lesson together, by the way, with no specific situation in mind. So if you and your family are facing the possibility of a family member or a loved one dying, if it's something that's a little bit raw for you, I can apologize, except there just really is, like I said, either never a good time to talk about it or always a good time to talk about it. So with all that being said, somebody sent me this earlier this week. It's a cartoon showing an elderly man with his son saying, "One day, son, all this will be yours," at Stu's self-storage. Now, this one hit me close to home because if you know anything about me at all, then you know that I am not one to amass possessions. In fact, I have what probably is the opposite condition of being a hoarder. My dad, on the other hand... I sent this to my parents. I texted the picture to them, and Dad didn't respond. Maybe I just made him angry. But Mom texted back and said, "And I can't wait for it to be out of my garage." Now, Solomon brings up a similar idea here in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, near the end of the chapter. But I would like to start here in verse 15 for context's sake. So follow along, if you will, in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, beginning in verse 15. And we may skip a verse here and there just to get to the point I'm getting to. But beginning in verse 15, "I said to myself, 'As is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise?' So I said to myself, 'This too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die.'" Solomon is saying, why have I put so much effort into everything in life? Why have I tried so hard with everything? Because I'm going to die in the same way as everybody else. The regular Joe on the street and the college professor, they're all going to die in the same way. They're all going to die, their bodies will decay, and they will become dust in the earth yet again. "So I hated life," he said in verse 17, "for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after the wind. So I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I'd labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me." I'm going to have to leave everything, my good stuff, my bad stuff, all of it, my favorite collections. All of that stuff is going to be under the power of the person who will come after me, and I won't have any control over it or any say over my things after that. And who knows whether he'll be a wise man and a fool, Solomon goes on to say in verse 19, "and yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. So I completely despaired," he says in verse 20. And in verse 21, "when there's a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and he gives his legacy..." That's, by the way, that's a loaded word, isn't it? "When he gives his legacy..." "When he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them, this too is vanity and a great evil." Now skip on down to verse 24. "There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him?" That's the question of the day, isn't it?
That was the question on Solomon's mind. Who can enjoy anything in this life if they do not first appraise it from a spiritual, godly perspective? You can't enjoy anything. There is nothing in this life that will satisfy you for very long, at least, if you do not first see it from a God perspective. Which is why he says in verse 26 in conclusion, "For to a person who is good in God's sight, he's given wisdom and knowledge and joy. And those are eternal gifts. While to the sinner, he's given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give it to one who is good in God's sight, and this to his vanity and striving after the wind." I want to focus on that idea of the gathering and collecting. You know, if we've studied Ecclesiastes ever at any point together, you know that's probably my favorite phrase in the entire book. He's given the task of gathering and collecting so that you can fill up a storage unit and leave it to your kids so that you can have that project car sitting in the garage for all those years. I was out running yesterday and I ran past somebody's open garage and I saw their 65 Mustang on cinder blocks. It's his hopes and dreams right there. Someday I'm going to fix up the Stang. Someday. You know, he's never going to get around to it. And it's his kids who are going to be like, "What are we going to do with the Mustang? I don't want the Mustang, do you?" Gathering and collecting. That's our life. You take God out of the picture, take anything spiritual out of the picture, and you are given the task of gathering and collecting a garage full of junk, so that someday somebody else is left with the problem of dealing with it. So I want to ask the question of what do we leave behind? What are we leaving behind in this life? What kinds of memories are we leaving behind? What kind of a reputation are we leaving behind? What kind of a story or a legacy are we leaving behind? What kind of impression do we leave behind on our children or our grandchildren? On other Christians, on sinners. What are we leaving behind? When you die, what is left behind on planet Earth? Well, Solomon wasn't the only one who talked about gathering and collecting stuff. Jesus also talked about treasures and stuff at different points in his ministry, perhaps most memorably in Matthew chapter 6. Notice how he puts it here in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6, beginning in verse 19. "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures upon earth." And you know, what is treasure upon the earth except just the thing that you value? Now, maybe what your treasure is just another person's junk, right? It's just another person's junk. But it's your treasure. It's the thing that you value, the thing that you think is important. "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures upon the earth where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." And throughout his ministry, Jesus turned to treasures and possessions and the accumulation of stuff to prove various points in different parables. Sometimes he used treasure as a good thing. Other times he used it as a bad thing. Now, in one example here in Matthew chapter 13, which was read earlier in our worship service, he talks about how there's a man who finds a field and there's a treasure in that field. And it's so valuable to him that he'll sell everything else and go buy that field so that he has access to the treasure. Or a man who sees a pearl of such great value that he'd give anything to have that pearl of great value. In that sense, the kingdom of heaven can be compared to a valuable treasure. But at other times, treasures and possessions and stuff can be seen in a negative way. In Luke chapter 12, for example, in 13 through 21, there's a man who decides to build bigger barns. And he spends all this time worrying about his stuff, his possessions, his barns, that he doesn't even take the time to think about God. And on that very night, as the text says, God comes to him and says, "Your soul is required of you. And what do you have to your credit right now?" In Luke chapter 12, verses 29 through 34, notice the way that Jesus puts it there. In fact, I want to go ahead and read this one because I like the way Jesus puts it, and I don't think you can just sum it up in a really fair way. Luke chapter 12, beginning in verse 29, where he says, "Do not seek what you shall eat and what you shall drink, and do not keep worrying, for all these things the nations of the world eagerly seek, but your Father knows that you need these things. He goes on to say in verse 31, but seek for his kingdom, and these things shall be added to you. Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom. Verse 33, sell your possessions, Jesus says, and give to charity. Make for yourselves purses which do not wear out. And I believe the prophets had a few things to say about that as well in the Old Testament. An unfailing treasure in heaven, where no thief comes near nor moth destroys. For, as we read in Matthew chapter 6 already, where your treasure is, there will your heart be. Also, there's the story of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke chapter 16 about a rich man who had all of his good things in this life, but he didn't spend any time worrying about the next life. So the poor man Lazarus is comforted in Abraham's bosom, but the rich man is in torment in the bad place. In Luke chapter 21, verses 1 through 4, Jesus sees a poor widow giving everything that she has to the temple collection. Just a couple of small copper coins. And he says she gave more than all these other people giving out of their abundance. And the amazing thing about his teaching, when he does talk about wealth and possessions and stuff and treasures, is that he always gives everybody something to think about. Both the poor man and the rich man walk away from the teaching of Jesus having something that they needed to hear. So going back to our question, when my life is all done, what will it amount to? Where have I put my treasures? Where did I put the emphasis? What was important to me in this life? What will I take with me to God, and what will I leave behind here on good old planet Earth? Now, before we get into more serious things, I actually have a couple of practical observations at the halfway point of our lesson. I just want to bring out a few practical things. These aren't going to be earth-shattering ideas, but I want to get them out of the way before we look at some bigger concepts. So, first is this. It's been said many times before, but it is definitely worth repeating in this lesson. Death can happen at any time, to anybody, anywhere. So, as much as it's possible, and I emphasize that, as much as it is possible for you, make appropriate preparations before you die. Think about death. It's the great equalizer, isn't it? It's the one thing all of us are going to do. I'm probably never going to see the Great Wall of China. Who knows? Maybe I will. Some people get to see it and some people don't. You know, I don't know if I'll ever go see the Eiffel Tower. Don't know if I have a desire to see the Eiffel Tower. To ride like the biggest roller coaster in America. I don't know. Who knows? But do you know the one thing we're all going to have in common? We're all going to die. That's a fact. Unless the Lord comes back in judgment first and cuts your life short, well, we're all going to die. That's a fact. So as much as it is possible, keep death in mind. You know, as you read the Bible, just scanning the pages, whether it's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or the Epistle of James, wherever it is, you find, amazingly enough, that the apostles and Jesus and other writers in the Bible, they did not shy away from talking about death. It is a frequent subject in the Bible. So as frequent as it is in the Bible, I find that we are so uncomfortable with it, we won't talk about it at times in a manner that is as frank as it ought to be. Discuss with your loved ones how you want your body dealt with. This isn't something we always think about, is it? But it really is something that we should prepare for so that there's no hand-wringing or guilt. Now, the fact is that you are not going to have a say in it once you die. You can say anything you want to your kids. I want to be dealt with in this way. I want my ashes like secretly spread in a football field or something like that. Right? You can tell your kids all this kind of like lofty stuff, and I want my remains dealt with in this way, but once you're dead, your kids can go, whatever, bury him in the ground. Like, you ultimately do not have a choice in the matter, but here's the benefit, just being more serious, here is the benefit to when you explain to your family at least what your wishes would be for your remains, it means that nobody has to feel guilty about what they do with your body. Okay, if you tell your family in advance, I don't need something expensive, if you get the cheapest coffin, that doesn't bother me one bit. If finances are a problem, get the cheapest package. I don't care. So that when the time comes and your family has to make that choice, and I'm being serious here, but when your family has to make that choice, nobody's sitting there feeling guilty like, well, we don't have the money for the expensive coffin, but we don't want to dishonor mom or dad or grandma and grandpa. If you just tell them that in advance, nobody has to feel guilty. Nobody has to feel guilty or blame anybody or pass the buck off if you say in advance, cremation or burial, whatever. You just, to me, the benefit is you remove that as a source of strife in your family. If you just talk to people frankly about it in advance before it happens. And we've got a couple of biblical examples of that as well. In Genesis 49, as Jacob, or Israel as he was called, was preparing for his own death, he requested that his family bury him in the same cave where Abraham was buried, and Sarah, and Isaac, and Rebekah, and one of his wives, Leah. He asked them to do that. Now, like I said, once he died, could his sons have chosen not to do that? Sure. But the fact that he made it clear to them removed any hand-wringing or guilt. He made it clear, this is what I want to have happen after I die. Joseph is the same way in Genesis chapter 15. Joseph wanted his bones to be taken back to Canaan someday when his descendants would leave Egypt and go to their own land. He wanted to make sure that his bones were taken with them. And they kept that. They kept that promise. But on a more serious note here, in Proverbs 13 and verse 22, it talks about inheritance and the value of inheritance. I know that not everybody has the money in this life to leave an inheritance, but it says in this verse, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. I saw a connection there as I was reading that, a connection back to that Ecclesiastes 2 passage. Remember in Ecclesiastes 2, the sinner is given the task of gathering and collecting, so that when he dies, his things will be left to better people. I think Proverbs 13 is saying kind of the same thing, isn't it? Now, maybe you don't have a ton of money in this life, and that's not a fault, right? That's not a moral failure in any way on your part. But when it comes to things like life insurance or having an inheritance or leaving something so that your family's not burdened with your debts or burdened with taking care of your final needs, whatever that is, if you have the ability to help in some way, plan for those things. Think about those things. And finally, keepsakes. Your possessions. You know, to you, it might just be your stuff. And sure, it is a garage full of stuff, and your kids probably see it as a garage full of stuff too. But something that just seems like a thing to you, an object that you're used to, may actually have a lot of sentimental value to a family member. So think about where some of your stuff needs to go. Think about the value, the memories that are attached to your things. Things like a Bible with your handwritten notes. To you, it's just your Bible. I mean, it's just got all your, you know, all the colors of the rainbow written in it. To me, this is just my Bible. I just use it every day. It's my Bible. I'm used to it. But there's something about Grandpa's Bible that's got his handwriting. There's something about that kids and grandkids really see a lot of value. I've got several, actually, of my grandpa's Bibles. He was a preacher, and I have several of his Bibles with handwritten notes. Mementos from military service. Those can be really valuable to kids and grandkids. Photographs. I think photographs is something we take for granted. In the age of Instagram and pictures on your phones, coming from someone who is fairly young and probably... I hate to call myself a millennial. I don't think of myself as a millennial, but people say that I am. There is something about holding a photograph in your hands that just, it's special. Pictures are so disposable now. You take 1,000 of them and you delete 999 of them. You take your selfies and you take pictures of your breakfast and whatever. There is something about that family photo that is a physical possession that you hold in your hands. Just keep those things in mind. Now, those are practical observations, but I want to look at three things of a deeper spiritual nature before we bring our lesson to a close. What we leave behind oftentimes is untapped potential. You don't want to leave that behind, but that's often one of the things that we leave behind here is untapped potential. In football, there's a term that commentators sometimes use, leaving points on the field. It's opportunities that you missed when you could have been more aggressive or more thoughtful about how you set up a play, and you missed an opportunity to score some points. They say you left points on the field. Don't be the sort of person that leaves untapped potential behind. Now, I put three examples up here, but the Bible is replete with many of these examples. Jehoshaphat, for example, he's a king that you can read about in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. And I want to read just a couple verses by way of summation in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Now, Jehoshaphat, in a lot of ways, was a great king. And to sum up his life, honestly, he was a great king. He was a man who set his affairs in order and loved God very much and tried, I think to the best of his ability, to be a God-fearing person. But he had this great big fault. He was absolutely infatuated with Ahab. There was just something about Ahab and Ahab's family that he was infatuated with Ahab and Ahab's dynasty. He went to battle one time with Ahab, and it was a complete disaster. That was the battle where Ahab was actually killed by an arrow in a joint in his armor. And Jehoshaphat barely made it home alive. And there were other examples also where he just had this strange infatuation with Ahab. Now, we pick up here in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, beginning in verse 31. Now, Jehoshaphat reigned over Judah. He was 35 when he became king. He reigned for 25 years. Verse 32, he walked in the way of his father Asa and did not depart from it. He did right in the sight of the Lord. However, the high places were not removed. The people had not directed their hearts to the God of their fathers. Skip on down here to verse 35. Now Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, allied himself with Ahaziah, king of Israel. He acted wickedly in so doing. So he allied himself to make ships to go to Tarshish, and they made the ships in Ezion-Geber. Then Eleazar, the son of a name I can't pronounce, prophesied against Jehoshaphat, saying, because you have allied yourself with Ahaziah, the Lord has destroyed your work. So the ships were broken and did not go to Tarshish. It, to me, it's a man who did a lot of things right in his life and really did love God. And just the sum of his life was a good thing. He did love God. But he could have done more with his life. And you have several examples here. Just the way that he didn't remove the high places. Imagine the spiritual dynasty, the legacy that he could have left if he had just been more aggressive when it came to leading the people spiritually. Tearing down those high places might have made a big difference in the coming generations. But you never saw it. That was potential that was left on the field. Points he didn't score. Going off and building a fleet of ships with Ahaziah. And I love the way the prophet just comes to him and says, because you've done a dumb, evil thing, this thing's not going to work out. And all those ships, those precious ships that he built, dashed against the rocks, ruined for whatever reason, rot in the wood. Who knows what it was that destroyed the ships. But that's potential. Potential that was wasted just because of a few bad choices. Josiah is a tragic character as well. Josiah was a good king. Really good king. But you know, Josiah died tragically. He died tragically when he stuck his nose in business that was above his pay grade. Assyria and Egypt were butting heads with each other. The great kingdoms of the north and the great kingdom of the south, they were butting heads with each other. And Josiah thought he was a little too big for those britches. He jumped in and thought he was going to involve himself in these grand affairs of the largest empires of the world. And he ended up dying in battle because of it. That's untapped potential right there. When you stick your nose in business that's not yours. Samson was the same way. Boy, you know, Samson leaves a very confusing story behind, doesn't he? Of all the good things that he did, there's all these things that we're going like, just scratching our heads at the story of Samson. How could a man be so bold and brave and courageous, but so dumb at the same time? And his life is summed up at the end of all things so perfectly. He ended up killing more Philistines in his death than he ever did in his life. And you look at that and you go, well, you know, that's untapped potential. When you accomplish more by dying than you ever did by living, untapped potential. My friends, when you die, don't leave a bunch of points on the field. Don't. You take your talents, you use them. Don't bury them in the ground like that one talent man in Matthew chapter 25. Do not waste it. Next thing is this, questions and doubts. My friends, the very worst inheritance that you can leave behind is uncertainty. I'll say that again. The very worst inheritance you can leave behind is uncertainty. Never leave people wondering where they stood with you or what you were really all about spiritually. This kind of goes back to the cartoon I showed you at the beginning of the lesson. That man had a storage unit full of junk. It was his stuff, and he was going to leave it behind. That's a guarantee. We're all going to leave stuff behind, aren't we? No matter how careful we are or fastidious we are with life, no matter how compulsive we are about our things, all of us are going to leave something behind. It's the memories and the sentiment attached to that stuff that's the real question. When people pull out your possessions and clean out your house and empty your garage, and they're going through your clothes and your photo albums and your file cabinets in your office, and your children and grandchildren are cleaning up your stuff, what is the memory and sentiment that is attached to it? Do they have questions about you? Do they wonder, what did Dad really think about me? What did Mom really think about me? Think about some passages in the Bible that give us some clarity. Husbands, love your wives in Ephesians 5:25. Does your wife know that you love her? Or when you die and go to your grave, is she going to wonder, did he really love me that much? Based on how he acted and how he talked, I always wondered, I always questioned, did he really love me that much? Husbands, love your wives. Do it now while you can. And wives, respect your husbands. Respect your husbands. Don't go to your grave where your husband is wondering where he ever stood with you, what your relationship was really all about. You love and you respect each other. And do it now while you can. Ephesians chapter 6 says, honor your father and your mother. Don't go to your dad's funeral regretting that you didn't tell him you loved him and that you honored him. And don't let your dad or your mom die wondering where they stood with you. Honor your father and your mother right now while you can. Do not exasperate your children. Don't drive your children crazy. When you die, don't let it be a relief that you died. Be subject to your elders in 1 Peter 5, verse 5. Our elders need to know that. They need to know that we're subject to them, that we honor them, that we don't just honor them, we give them double honor, and we esteem them very highly in their work. Be subject to your elders. Do it now. But elders, rule well. Kind of like with fathers and mothers, when you die, don't let it be a situation where everybody finally breathes a sigh of relief that you died. Rule well. Rule well. Shepherd the flock of God among you. Appreciate hard workers in the church. Do you tell hard workers in the church that you appreciate them? Or do people wonder where they stand with you? Love your enemies in Matthew 5:44. Do your enemies know that you love them? Do your enemies know that you prayed for them? Hey, just so you know, in spite of everything you've said to me over the years, I prayed for you last night. I've been praying for your soul all these years, and I still pray to this day that you'll listen to the gospel message one day. I love you, and I'm praying for you. Do your enemies know that? Don't leave questions behind. Don't leave doubts behind when you die. That is the worst inheritance that you could possibly leave your people. And the last point is this. Learn to leave some things behind right now. Don't wait until you die to leave things behind. Learn to drop the junk in your life. Leave it behind right now. There's plenty of stuff we can leave behind right now and look forward to the home in heaven. Matthew chapter 19, for example, we read about a rich young ruler there who comes to Jesus and says, I want to learn a little bit about the kingdom. What do I need to do? What do I need to do to get eternal life and be part of your kingdom? And they have a little conversation here, and Jesus realizes, there's one thing that you're lacking, because you said everything right so far. I got one more challenge for you, O rich young ruler. One more thing to tell you. One more thing that you're lacking. If you wish to be complete, he says in Matthew 19, verse 21, go and sell your possessions, give them to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven, and come follow after me. That's the one thing. And that, to me, that's the most tragic part of this story, is when you have only one thing, one more step to take, one final rung of the ladder to climb, and he couldn't do it. One thing separated him from a place in the kingdom of heaven. And the young man heard this statement and went away grieved, because he was one who owned much property. Now the disciples chime in at that, and they say, who can be saved in verse 25? With men this is impossible, verse 26, but with God all things are possible. They chime in verse 27 here. Behold, we've left everything and followed you. What then will there be for us? They looked at the example of the rich young ruler and they said, we were able to do that. Right? We could do that. Now, they weren't nearly as rich as that rich young ruler. And that's why Jesus said, it's very hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, pick up here in verse 28. This is the point I want to get to here. Truly I say to you that you who have followed me in the regeneration, when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, you shall also sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or farms for my name's sake shall receive many times as much and shall inherit eternal life. And that's why I wanted to get to this here. Let's flip the script a little bit and quit talking about all the stuff that we leave as an inheritance and talk about the inheritance that we want to receive in the afterlife. When you can be like the rich young ruler and learn to leave it behind, when you learn that earthly things belong on planet Earth and your soul is a heavenly thing that belongs in heaven, you leave that behind and you'll have a lot more treasure in heaven waiting for you. Treasure that can't be counted in dollars and cents. Treasure that can't be counted in cubic footage. Treasure that cannot be counted in houses or square footage or property or acreage or any of that stuff. The better treasure. The heavenly treasure. You'll receive many times as much and shall inherit eternal life. But you have to learn to leave it behind. You have to. Paul made a very similar statement in the book of Philippians. It's up on the screen. You can study it on your own time if you would like to follow up with that. But in Philippians chapter 3, he talks about all the things that he had to his credit. I could boast if I wanted to, he says. I've got every reason to boast, in a physical sense at least. But I counted all those things as, what's the word he uses? Rubbish. They're rubbish. I counted all those things as rubbish. So I leave it behind. And I press on to the goal that's ahead of me. A heavenly goal. A heavenly goal. So, what are you going to leave behind? And what is waiting for you on the other side of that great door that we're all going to pass through called death? What do you leave behind with your kids and your grandkids? What do you leave behind of members of the church, our elders, people that you respected? What do you leave behind with your enemies? What impression do you leave? What memories, sentiment, emotions, legacy? And what is it worth to you to enter heaven? Well, as Jesus said in Matthew chapter 16, a man could gain the whole world, but if he loses his soul, he's lost everything. If you're not a Christian, you need to be. You need to be a Christian. And you have an opportunity right now to make that happen. So whatever spiritual need you might have, please let it be known by coming forward as we stand in